Award-winning author Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg is scholar in residence at the National Council of Jewish Women. She's published 7 books so far, and the latest on repentance and repair, making amends in an unapologetic world, came out earlier this year. It leans on Jewish wisdom and encompassing universal values. It's a powerful, super timely, and ultimately practical call to action. Danya, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I do want to start by saying I have followed you very closely on social media. And I just think it's you are someone who should be lifted up. They're going to lift you up in future. They're going to go back and say, who were religious leaders that made a difference on social media? And I think you are par excellence, someone who has used that platform. Specifically, I follow you on Twitter to help make plain some things that are difficult and to really, you know, do things in a graceful way, a clear way, and coming out of your tradition, like deeply in your tradition. So I applaud you for that because it's not an easy feat. It's something I look at really closely. And I thank you for that. And before we get into your book, which actually, as I learned in your book, had an origin story of Twitter, I'm curious how you're feeling, and I'm sorry to spring this on you, how you're feeling about Twitter right now. As someone who thinks deeply, lay some Jewish wisdom on us on what to do about Twitter.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Let's see if I have any Torah.
Come on.
State of Twitter. I feel like I'm standing in the palace watching the colonnades fall around us. It is true that Twitter has always been corporate owned. You know, it's always had significant problems in terms of far right influences and disinformation and trolls and not banning Nazis and all of that. And it has been the critical space in the public square for enabling marginalized voices to be heard, for the birth of movements, Arab Spring, Black Lives Matter, Me Too. I mean, we really have to give Twitter the credit that it is due. And it's very sad to watch it falling apart piece by piece, and to watch darker forces creep in.
Yeah.
I think the Torah is just to, as King Solomon said, King Solomon asked for a ring, as the legend goes, that would make him happy when he's sad and sad when he's happy. And so he got a ring, and on the ring it was written, Gamze Yavor, right? This too will pass. And so I think we just need to be present in what's happening, to stay put. I personally am staying put for the moment. I still have this secret hope that the government or the public library or somebody's going to swoop in and save it. And if this is the end of this, I have faith that something new will emerge to be the space for people to communicate across communities, to organize and build movements. I believe that something will come. I do not know what it is. And it's scary because we don't know what that is yet.
I'm going to be looking for your wisdom on that as I look for your wisdom on many things. I want to get into your amazing book. It's on repentance and repair, making amends in an unapologetic world. And as part of that, I want to understand a little bit more about you for people who don't know you. You're a rabbi. Where do you come out of? Like, what's your background, and how did you get to this point where you felt like you had to write this book?
Well, those are two, my background in terms of my own upbringing. I was not, I was raised in kind of a typical American Jewish household of the kind of suburban, semi-affiliated type. We went to synagogue a couple times a year. We had Passover Seders. We weren't particularly observant at home. And my own relationship to Judaism was you know, long and winding and weird, and that story didn't really start until I was in my 20s. That is a whole long story. I wrote a book about that.
What was the name of that book, in case people want?
Surprised by God. It's a story of how a grumpy punk rock little atheist wound up discovering, somewhat out of grief in the glitter of late 90s San Francisco, spiritual practice that changed her life.
Amazing. So, wow. I want to spend some time with that book. First of all, Punk Rock Rabbi is like what I need in my life. And so I'm very there. That does give me a flavor of like how you're coming at the work that you do. And then why this book now?
So the book really started out of Me Too 5 years ago, as we as a country and a culture began asking a new set of questions. There were all of these famous men that had been named as sexual abusers and issued these weak sauce statements, you know, yes, I did it, but the real problem is that my family is sad now, or what are my fans going to think? And, you know, nobody's really mentioning the victims, the impact and the harm that they caused, right? It's like, oh no, you know, this is so sad for me personally. And this question of like, now what, right? They've issued these statements. They're saying they're going to go away. Maybe they're fired. I don't know. Like, now what? What do we do? And particularly if it's not a people are pressing charges, getting into the legal department. And a friend of mine who's a journalist asked me some questions that I responded. And then I sort of threw my response also on Twitter, taking the Jewish framework for repentance, which for us is not about feeling bad. It's about a set of actions that one does to take responsibility for one's harm and to center the victim's needs, attend the victim's needs, and clean up your mess, but also do the work of growing and changing so you don't do the thing again. And I was like, well, here's what we would look for if these dudes were really taking seriously what they did and cleaning up the work. Like, this is my guess about what we would see in terms of how it would leak out in terms of the public and the impact, because they didn't just harm these specific victims. It's like their fans and like, what does this mean about rape culture? And there are all of these eyes on these people. And the response was shocking. People were like, whoa, wait, we ask things of the perpetrator? Wait, the person who did harm has to do stuff? We don't just push the victims to forgive? What? And I started to, in these dialogues with people on Twitter, I started to realize that our culture just has this hole in this space that we don't know what to ask of perpetrators. We say we want justice. We don't always know what that means, and it often sounds like revenge. And we put all this emotional labor on victims without knowing how to care for them. And, you know, Judaism has a whole system.
Yeah. Well, so talk a little bit about that. Like, I love it when someone like from the 500s or something like that comes in. You know what we need now? We need someone who was living 1500 years ago who actually was thinking about this and actually might have some wisdom to offer. I mean, talk about like where you went to find this, you know, to find some of the Jewish wisdom that you ended up offering.
I love me a dead guy.
Wow. Okay. If there's one quote from this, if there's one quote we're going to like lift out, Rabbi says she loves a dead guy. Okay, good. We got that much. All right.
My time running around reading books by dead guys. But, you know, I discovered feminism and philosophy both in high school. And so reading dead guys in library. Yeah. Kind of my library.
Wow, nice. So
Maimonides, the 12th century philosopher.
My fault, sorry. I was in the wrong century.
He's quoting 5th century people, so it's
okay.
But Maimonides is 12th century. He's a philosopher. He's a Torah scholar. He's a physician. He's one of the greats of my tradition. And what he did is he took basically all of the wisdom that was all over the place in different places around our tradition up until then. And he reorganized it, and he made some personal choices about, you know, what positions we're going to take. And, you know, there's a lot of chutzpah involved in his rearranging, but, you know, what pieces of what things. But he rearranged things in a way that it would be easier for people who are not scholars to understand what to do and how to do it. Mm. And like people who are really scholars can continue to read the winding debates of the Talmud, and the regular folk just need something more straightforward. And in that rearranging, this book called the Mishneh Torah included what we call the laws of repentance, Hilchot Teshuva. And when I read the laws of repentance, I see five distinct steps for how you do the work of owning the harm that you have caused, attending to it, and doing the work of transformation.
Can you give us just? I want people to read the book, so we are going to, you know, on repentance and repair is the book. But we're a taste. Just like, what are the five steps, if you don't mind articulating those, and then how, you know, some of, maybe we can talk a little bit of like an example of where you've seen that done well. So that people might be, you know, not so afraid of actually entering, because I think there's a lot of fear about entering into this conversation. Even
mm-hmm. there's so much fear. Understandably, but
yeah. I mean, it's, you know, but let's start with the five steps.
Okay, so number one, is confession. You have to own what you did out loud. Fully. No hedging, no trying to make yourself look better than really is merited, right? No, what I meant, really, I'm a good person, right? We don't care. Own what you did, name it, which you'll note requires all this pre-work of having to cross this bridge from the story of like, I'm always like the good guy, I never do anything bad, right? You have to kind of acknowledge that, listen, you're not an irreparably bad person if you cause harm this one time, right? We are all people and we do stuff. And sometimes the stuff we do is great and sometimes it's not so great. And when we do the not so great things, we need to clean up. And so you have to face the part where today was not, you know, like you messed up, and name it and own it. And ideally, like, it's praiseworthy, Maimonides says, to do it publicly, because that is A, asking for accountability, right? From everybody. You're saying, guys, I need some help here, right? I'm struggling. Like in some way I was not able to be my best self. And I need your help and support to become the kind of person that I want to be.
Right?
I'm on my journey with anti-racism. I'm struggling with my sobriety. I don't want to be this angry all the time anymore. Whatever it is, right?
Right.
So that's owning it.
Yes.
And it's critical for the victim, because this can be the end to the gaslighting.
Uh-huh.
Right? It can validate their experience, right? This really happened and it was not their fault, right? They didn't invite whatever. They didn't lead anybody, you know, right? It's clear, and it's clear to everybody. So that's step one, owning it. Step two, begin to change. Because if you finish this process and then you go around and go do the same thing again, like, there's no, we haven't succeeded.
Right.
You make future victims no.
Which again, you know, I mean, if you say, you know, change takes work. That's, you know, I mean, so that's, again, like, all of this is actually very, it's about actions. The action of confession, the action of work to change, all of it is like, it's all, but I think that, you know, I think that once you is what I'm hearing is a roadmap, which sometimes is what people lack. And right. so you you change, and then what can that lead to?
So, well, first, you know, like change can be a bunch of different things. Like, do you need therapy? Do you need right. to hook up with a spiritual director? Do you need to call your sponsor? Do you need to learn more about anti-racism or trans liberation? Right. Do you need to ditch the friends that make you behave badly? If we're talking about an institution that's caused harm, does HR need to revise their policies so that they don't bury complaints anymore? Do they need to fire their board, right? What needs to happen so that that can't happen again? Then we get to amends, right? What does the victim need? What kind of care and redress would feel like we can't undo what happened, but it will feel like at least it can sew up that hole in the cosmos that has been created, right? It's remuneration. It is reparations.
Right.
And I'm using that word intentionally.
No. I'm hearing it.
And you can't make amends at a person. If you decide for them what the reparations are, then you're still treating them as an object instead of an autonomous subject that gets to decide for themselves. You have to ask, what do you need? And the answer might be different than what you would have assumed. And that's a learning too.
Right.
And then after amends, after you have done the work of actually fixing in some way, then the apology, right? Action first. Second.
That's super interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Like, you know, when they say actions speak louder than words, I mean, it really, I think that's like super important, you know, and I'm just like blown away. We're still with Maimonides, right? I mean, this is like, you know, this is someone like 12th century, dead guy, who is like, has recognized that this was something going on then. Like, this is not unique to our generation. This is actually something that is a human situation. And people from that long ago and longer have had to approach this. So, I mean, I think that's amazing. So we're at step four with apology.
Right. And this is, and presumably it's because if you did the apology right at the confession step, you're still the harm doer, basically. Like, nothing's changed. And so then it's checking a box. Whereas if you've been already, all of these things and all of this learning has happened, you're a different person and you get it in a different way. Mm. And so that apology is coming from this place of remorse and a deeper space of being actually able to see the person that you hurt. And it's coming from a more open heart. And then after apology, then you know, step five is pretty organic. Like, if you've done all of this work and you've done it correctly, then pretty easily you get to the last place, which is when the opportunity to do the thing again comes up, and it always does. You don't do it. You make a different choice.
Yeah, I mean, this is so helpful. And I just, you kind of imagine this is interpersonal. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, this can happen at a familial level. It can happen certainly in religious institutions. Yep. I mean, you know, if you want to drive yourself crazy, listen to pastors talk about how they, women should stay with their abusing husbands and forgive them. I mean, you know, I can't even... You know, I mean, I didn't have the language that you've just given me to talk about it, but this is like, you know, you know, when you're making that kind of shortcut, that it's just non-existent. But then it can also be society. I mean, you know, when we think about what we're wrestling with the legacy of slavery in this country and how fearful people are, white people, I'll say, about like the conversation about reparations. You know, and, you know, reparations did happen, by the way, after the end of slavery. It was the white people who got, who got money because their slaves were no, this is real. This is real.
This is like,
the slavers got money and it was called reparations. Is that nuts or nuts? So, you know, so I mean, not nuts because, you know, it should not be surprising, but we have used the term reparations terribly before, but in our country, if we think about, you know, that this ain't really, really like relevant, but also, you know, deep Jewish wisdom from the 12th century, we could actually begin down that path, but people are so scared about it. That it's, you know, it's terrifying, but also it can be in, you know, as you say, it could be institutions. It can be anywhere. I mean, it's all of us, by the way. Like, I like the way you said that. It's just like, this is not like those people should really be looking at this. You know, none of us are perfect. And so I do think like the roadmap idea is like the next time we're in a situation where we're seeing this, I just think like I want to, again, on repentance and repair, making amends in an unapologetic world. Talk to me about unapologetic. Like, that is a really interesting kind of, you know, colon, boom. Like, what does that mean to you? What does it mean to you when we say an unapologetic world?
I know unapologetic is usually used in this, like, you know, kind of, often in this like kind of corporate white feminism, girl power kind of way, like, but it's actually not good to not apologize. And the defensiveness that people have,
right,
to not actually reckon with the right. harm that right. they have caused, yeah, it's a yeah, problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, as you're saying, like, listen, we all are harm doers. We all have been harmed. We're all bystanders to harm, right? This is all of us.
Yeah, yeah. And but there are specific things that we should be, as a nation, I will say, that are not equal and that are will continue to plague us until we, you know, and I know you know this much better than I do, but like, you know, until we address the kind of extraordinary misogyny and racism in this country. It's just not, you know, we're not going to become the nation that we, I think, envision for ourselves.
Right. And I really, truly believe that these five stages of repentance could truly bring us to a more equal, equitable, and just and whole future for our country. And I mean, it's fascinating. The 1619 Project was an extraordinary invitation, right? It was extraordinary truth telling, right? It's sort of laid bare all of the ways that the legacy of slavery and the way that white supremacy is shot through in pretty much every aspect of American life, right? It's in housing, it's in the medical. Every aspect of the medical world. It's in our traffic patterns, right? Or the way our traffic patterns work is shot through white supremacy, right? Music, everything. And when it was published, that's not the confession step, because confession has to come from the harm doer.
Right.
In this case, I would say on the level of national harm, we're talking about the U.S. government, right? We're not talking about every individual white person.
Right.
And folks listening, there's a difference between responsibility and guilt. It's okay to be white. I'm white, right? You don't have to feel bad, but you do have to see that there's a problem and decide to be part of a solution, God. Right?
Don't get me going down the CRT, like, ridiculous.
What happened? Right, but that's the thing. She basically said, here's some truth, guys. Can we open up the story and do some confession, start to the confession and the start to change stuff? And America said no. In fact, we are going to pass 36 states have passed laws saying we are not going to teach accurate history we're not going to teach about anti-racism or whatever. Right?
Yeah. I mean, so that the entire process has basically been basically stopped. Right. There, you know, it, you know, so.
Right.
You know,
can I say one more thing about this?
Yeah, please.
One more thing that I think is really important as we talk about reparations and talk about grappling with the legacy of slavery and the, you know, hundreds of years of systemic racism is that it's very tempting to want to say, like, oh, the United States should offer reparations to Black Americans and then everything will be fixed. And this is the whole, this is where I think this guideline can help remind us that that's not so simple, right? First, own the harm. Then number two, make start to change, like make sure the harm can't happen again. Mm. So that means looking at all of the ways that white supremacy and systemic racism drive our country and working on changing that. If we, you know, pass out some money that one time and say, great, we're done, we fixed it, and then all of our systems are still irredeemably racist, we haven't actually done the work.
Right. Right. No, thank you. I mean, we're close to time, but I do want to just, you know, I want to address what has to be troubling for all Jewish Americans. It's troubling for me is this, the rise of anti-Semitism and the permission being given. I wonder how you're thinking about that in terms of your own safety and your community. And as someone who actually has a big picture of American like society, like how are you talking about the way we should be talking about anti-Semitism in this particular moment?
For the last 1,000 years, how anti-Semitism has functioned is that during times of instability or crisis, the people in power have said, blame the Jews, not us. And so then there's the pogrom, and then there's the expulsion, and then there's the whatever. And so the peasants, instead of being mad at whoever's actually in power, they go after the Jews, right? Look at Christian history in Europe. That's basically what happened. That's how we got the Holocaust. That's it. That's the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and the Tsar trying to start things up in the 1905 revolution. And that's what's happening now, right? Blame the Jews, not us. That is why anti-Semitism undergirds Christian nationalism. To say, you know, nothing of the fact that, you know, all the streams of Christianity that are mad that the Jews never converted, but, we have to just name that and keep naming that and naming the ways that anti-Semitism functions as this shadow. You know, it's like it works as a the shadowy, the cabal, the deep state, the people behind the scenes, the people pulling the strings. Like those tropes are meant to be, you know, like it's supposed to be hard to name and hard to grasp. And so, of course, we're seeing it now. And of course, we're seeing it with the rise of Christian nationalism. And many Jews in America are white. And so we have white privilege. Not all Jews are white. And so we have to be able to hold both our benefit, the fact that we benefit from white privilege, and the fact that we are targeted by white nationalism. Like, those are both true. Yep. And the bottom line is we have to be in solidarity with everybody else. We have to, white supremacy is the enemy, and, you know, it's solidarity or bust.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, I think that this is like, I think helping us see how this is part of a broader moment that we're in, and not like some sort of separate thing, but also something really that is, I mean, you know, is really affecting, you know, individuals, families, really fearful on the kind of rhetoric. And I have to say, like, you know, the craziness of the former president talking about how, like, Jews better get it together because, you know, I've been the best on Israel. And, you know, I mean, everything he's doing right now is just textbook division, and this terrible trope about, like, you know, dual. I mean, I can't even go there. It was just like it is. You know, we're in a moment where it's very the strings are so tangled that if you don't watch out, it's just going to tangle us all, and we're going to find ourselves, you know, completely in a mess.
Yeah. A mess. I mean, what Trump did was actually textbook white nationalism, right? Yeah. The Jews, but like white America is white people's white people's country. Jews don't belong here. Jews belong in Israel. And by the way, he's also playing to the evangelicals who want the Jews all to go to Israel so that the war of Gog and Magog can happen. And you know, nobody cares about Palestinians in this scenario, of course.
Yeah,
like,
No.
But that the Jews and Palestinians basically blow each other up and then the rapture happens. And so it's not actually caring about the sanctity of Jewish life. And it's also completely ignoring the fact that, like, I'm sorry, I'm an American. Like, this is my country. I am not Israeli.
You're right.
And this is my country. But it's the dual loyalty. Yeah. But it's basically it's white nationalism and white nationalism and Christian nationalism have become friends.
All right, Rabbi, I am asking all of our guests today to list three books that they love, in addition to their own, to share with our listeners. Who would you like for our listeners to know about?
So one of the books that just blew me out of the water this year was called Becoming Kin, An Indigenous Call to Unforgetting the Past and Reimagining the Future by Patty Krawick. And she's a native writer. She's in Canada, so First Nations. And it's visionary. It both teaches people how to decolonize their thinking and then invites them in, right? It's about becoming kin, invites them into the world in which native thinking and native visions are centered, but that includes and expands for everybody, right? And offers a profound vision of what can be.
I love that. Love that.
Yeah. And there's a book of poems by a friend of mine, actually, Hila Ratzabi. It's called There Are Still Woods. And it is, I mean, she's brilliant. And it is a haunting book of, it's a love song to nature, but it's a haunting kind of elegy in the face of global disaster, in the face of the burning of our planet, and this moment of poignancy, both understanding where we are and sort of just naming where we are in a really profound way.
Say the title and the author again.
So it's called There Are Still Woods, and it's Hila Ratzabi.
Mm, great. And one more?
One more is probably going to be named by other people, but I can't not. Rest is Resistance, a manifesto. Trisha Hersey is the Knapp Bishop, and her work talking about rest as reparations is so important. And, you know, there's a lot of Jewish thinking about Shabbat as anti-capitalist and the first labor laws and all of that. But her reading of the importance of rest specifically for Black people whose labor has been exploited for hundreds of years is so important.
Amazing. Thank you so much for those three books. Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, a scholar in residence at the National Council of Jewish Women. Her latest book is titled On Repentance and Repair, Making Amends in an Unapologetic World. Danya, I really appreciate having you with us today on State of Belief Radio. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's so fun to talk to you. Thank you so much.